Museum of the Moving Image welcomes you to the Pinewood Dialogues Online, an archive of conversations with innovative creative figures in film, television, and digital media. Visit Museum of the Moving Image in New York City or online at www.movingimage.us.
We're very pleased to bring out on stage Jason Bateman.
There you go.
Thank you. Hello. Hey. What a beautiful theater. Oh, my God. Wait, you didn't watch it on that, did you?
They just watched the curtain. They just watched the curtain, actually. I do have, by the way, all of the misspelled words from the National Spelling Bee, so we could try you out later if you feel like it. How is your spelling in general?
It's really good when there are big white cue cards just off camera.
Oh, okay, yeah. Okay.
That one, floxinosiny hillipilification, was written 6 or 7 times all over the... So I could go F-L-O... C-I, F-I, you know, so I
right.
could find...
Okay. So, you know, you seem to be one of these actors who wants to be a director or always wanted to, because you actually, what I read was you had your DGA card when you were 18. Is that true?
Yeah. When I was doing The Hogan Family with Mr. Steve Whitting, who is here tonight. Stan, Steve. There he is. You recognize him? Huh? That's our proctor or announcer, as he likes to be referred to. He wanted me to go in there, unlock picture, and change his credit to announcer. Pronouncer. See, he's still pissed off. So Steve and I were doing The Hogan Family, and I just asked for an opportunity to direct the show because we were all so having so much fun. It looked like it would be cool to do that, and they let me. And yes, that I got a phone call that week from the DGA. Said, "Did you know that you beat Malcolm Jamal Warner by 3 months and Steven Spielberg by 6?" Or I was like, "Whoa!" I got very nervous. So I don't know if it still stands, but that was a fun thing at the time.
Okay. And so tell us about just when, you know, how this wonderful script, you know, how that came to you and how you decided this would be your first film as a director. I mean, you had started a production company a few years ago.
This came to me because I asked for it. I said to my director agent, you get agents for certain different things. And so I said to my director agent, I said, you know, I don't want you to wait until your colleague down the hall, my actor agent, tells you that, you know, there's an opening in my schedule before you start to pursue directing for me, because I've been acting primarily for the past 15 or 20 years to try to create enough capital or relevance or access in the industry where somebody might give me an opportunity to direct. I said, if you think that the community would let me do that now, then please send me a script, because I don't have any objectivity about that. And he said, I think you might be able to get a small movie made now. So he sent me three scripts. This was one of them. Mm-hmm. And because I am embarrassed to say I have a fairly dark sense of humor, this one was attractive to me. And it also, you know, to be able to make at least some of what's in the film palatable, there was a necessity to kind of build a tone and an aesthetic around the film where there's kind of a rawness, a melancholy, an introspective type of mood, so that this humor came from a person who's going through some hurt feelings, and in fact he says as much at the beginning. So that's what I have always wanted to do with directing is deal in a very detailed way with multiple departments. So with production design, with lighting, with camera work, with music, and to try to shape an experience for an audience. And I knew that if we were going to pull something like this off, I would have to do something like that. So that's what was attractive.
So what were some of the discussions like early on in pre-production about how you were getting this tone? I mean, what you sort of set up right in the beginning, there's a certain like warmth to the film, to the colors and the look of the film. You know, yet we get this very sharp, dark humor right at the beginning as well. So it's really great how the film is mixing these this kind of, you know, warmth and cynicism or darkness, whatever you call it. And you do it. You seem very assured about how you're doing this as a director.
Well, thank you. It's just, I don't know. You use a long lens to sort of kind of get inside somebody's. It's more personal. It's more voyeuristic as opposed to a wide angle lens up front. It just feels a little bit more sort of popcorn. There's a bunch of different things, and I'm learning a lot about all that stuff. But it's certainly been something I've been attracted to for a long time, and I'm enjoying the process of learning what that vernacular is, so I can communicate efficiently with those departments. You notice and you feel these things as a moviegoer, but it's another thing entirely to know how to articulate those things so that you can try to get that department to give you that feeling. A film that we used as a sort of a template, a palette for this is Being John Malkovich, which is a comedy by category, but certainly doesn't have any jokes in it. And yeah, I mean, there's no written jokes, but there's tons of humor. But the humor comes from these pretty raw people going through something completely absurd, but in a very measured, trying way, and those stakes kind of generate a frustration or a lack of dignity that makes us sane people laugh. And there's a visual component to that, I think.
And how did you like the challenge of sort of working in the genre of the spelling bee movie? You know, we associate that with just like cuteness and stories of triumph and sort of everything that's kind of the opposite of where the humor is in this film,
right,
in a way?
Yes, there is kind of a contradiction there that is kind of fun conceptually and maybe something that the marketing department can kind of sink their teeth into. Kind of there's a fox in the hen house situation. But truthfully, the spelling bee element of it was a repellent to me because who needs to see another goddamn spelling bee movie? You know?
Right.
And you know, an adult.
You've probably killed off the genre now. It would hard to do a serious one.
We stepped on its neck with this one. The trope of a reluctant adult befriending a sweet kid is, I mean, W.C. Fields started that, and then Walter Matthau, and I mean, we don't need to see another one of those either. So, those are two things that I really wanted to just have serve as the spelling bee would simply be a venue for this guy with a very limited set of skills to handle his adult hurt feelings, and the adult boy thing I thought was workable since, as we find out, the adult needs the boy as much as the boy needs the adult, because the boy has been abandoned, the adult's been abandoned, that whole thing. And plus, with all the caustic humor coming from my character to him, we need to earn it with what we think is that predictable element. That's, you know, you might walk in and you go, okay, this is going to be a predictable, they're going to end up being friends. But as soon as you see them, as soon as I tell him to shut his fucking curry hole, you're like, yeah. They better become friends. So it's sort of this, and you see that sweet little smile on his face that he's actually enjoying this guy. You think, okay, good. So the kid's good with it. I'll be good with it.
Was there anything in the script that did go like too far, or is everything?
Well, I mean, the menstruation scene is still hard for me to, and that was my idea. You know, it's just like that was a tough one. Yeah, there's some parts of this film that are uncomfortable, and we weren't trying to be provocative and shock jockey, but this is a guy who is not together, and there's nothing funny about somebody who's got it all together, and this guy doesn't to a large extent. And but there's something I hope that is winning, that is vulnerable, that is redemptive about him, in that he's like a fifth grader that pulls a girl's hair to tell her that he likes her. I mean, that's not something we would do, but a fifth grader with fifth grader skill set would do that, and it's kind of sweet. But I had my work cut out for me to show flashes of this guy's immaturity, even though his veneer is very dismissive and exhausted and adult at times. You know, not the least of which is his intellect.
Where did you find this actor? The kid actor is so great, and so much of the chemistry that you have is just so important to the film, because everything that you do that's shocking, like nothing phases him. Yeah. I mean, I just love that. And, well, and you're both so articulate.
Like, yeah, well, he's a Juilliard graduate. He's 29 years old.
great he's makeup.
Got,
yeah.
He's got... about in the alleyway, the hypothyroid retention problem. That's the truth. That's no. He's a really bright 10-year-old kid that he's just got such a. I mean, how great is that kid? He's got this natural, like, sunny disposition that is infectious and such a necessary counterbalance to the cynicism of Guy Trilby. That when I saw his audition. Honestly, I didn't know how to judge the talent of a 10-year-old actor. I needed to see 20, 30 kids before I went back and saw his tape, which was really, I think he was the second audition I looked at. He lives here in New York, so it was a self-tape. I was so confused about how to judge talent of such a young person. I said to the casting director, I said, you know, it's tough enough to find a 10-year-old actor. Let's not make it even tougher by being specific about ethnicity. You know, we'll find different racist things to say about some other, I mean, you know, Guy Trilby doesn't care where he's going to spray it, you know? And so let's even a girl, didn't matter. Let's go 13, 14 years old. And before we really opened up the casting process, in fact, I went down the road with the little kid who plays Eric Tai, the third to last kid, that cute little blonde kid. I almost cast him as Chaitanya. We were close. And I was like, let me look at Rohan's tape one more time so we don't have to do the whole rewriting process. And what was apparent, blatantly apparent in his audition is that thing you can't change, which is his how comfortable he is in his skin and how warm and wonderful he is, and it just was this great balance. And we did a Skype session, and it was clear that he wasn't faking it, and his dad's in the background. And he was clearly, you know, this great tree that, you know, gave this acorn. I mean, it was like, it was authentic. And I knew the dad was going to be on the set. So they flew out for a couple of days of rehearsals and then away we went.
What was the best training for you as a director? I mean, you've worked so much and done, but, you know, what do you feel really like prepared you the most to direct?
Just having a great seat as an actor to see the process, you know, I mean, I'm right there watching it all happen for all you actors in the room. If there are any, I'm sure there's some, it's a really privileged spot to watch the process. And it is an incredibly complicated, intricate process, or can be, if you want to make it as a director. It is appropriate for you to contribute meaningfully to every department. And so I was watching this process for so long and wanted to someday earn the privilege of overseeing it, you know?
And so you want to keep directing, right? I'm assuming.
Yeah, full-time would be great. I probably will, since I'm so attracted to things of a very specific tone, my chances of hitting that tone accurately are increased if I'm in front of the camera and behind it, at least for my own personal taste. Not saying like that's the only way it's going to be good, but just for my own personal, what I kind of would like to see.
So you always were going to star in the film?
No. I took a couple of swings at some big shot actors that are twice as talented as I am, and they both told me to go screw myself. and then before I went to choice 3, 4, 5, and 6, I thought, because I've got some, I always play the put upon guy, the straight guy, the vulnerable guy, you know, us, you know, the guy in the middle. And so I've got some tricks up my sleeve to show those flashes of doubt and melancholy. And I knew that if I just kind of breadcrumb that through the script, through the movie a little bit, we might earn some of these bigger swings comedically. And so I thought, well, maybe I'll play the part. And plus, I would cut down my workload greatly by not having to direct a lead actor, which can sometimes, it can be kind of laborious. The creative negotiation is, I mean, it's a healthy one, but it can take a lot of time. And we didn't have a lot of time on this.
And what was it like, just on kind of an emotional level, like playing this character? And there's two parts to that. One is the kind of liberating part, maybe, of playing the foul mouth part of the character, who could just say anything. But then there is that redemptive side. I mean, a kid who you know, or an adult who has to like go from being a kid to actual adult.
What was it like
for you emotionally, yeah, just to play this character?
It was, I mean, emotionally it was exhilarating to play again for you actors. I mean, if you can grab a character that either has multi dimensions put in the script, or if it's written kind of one-dimensionally, the challenge of finding the moments to inject that other dimension, you know, if you're playing a murderer, like, what's the scene where I can show that this guy is somewhat remorseful or whatever it is. So that was a great, great challenge. And it was very fulfilling to bite off that, yeah, much.
Yeah. And I just want to ask you one thing, then we'll take some audience questions. But I was at the Toronto Film Festival where this film had its premiere, and it got such an amazing response there. I mean, you know, people, and this is where Gravity premiered and 12 Years a Slave, and everybody was who had seen your movie was saying, oh, you should see Jason Bateman's film. Like, it was like sort of a surprise. And there was a bidding war.
It was because the bar was very low. This guy, he took the cap off the
camera.
It's
in focus,
I mean,
yeah. It's, yeah. But it had a great, I mean, you're being modest, but it had a great, incredible response, and there was a bidding war over the film right away.
Yeah, I mean, that dream scenario. We got a very warm reaction from them. There's such a nice group of film fans up there at that festival every year, and they really seem to enjoy the film. And fortunately, the people who were there to look at it for distribution, they were in the theater at the time. So we got a bunch of nice bites that night, and it was that classic, you know, scenario where you go to the hotel after the night's over and you're checking your emails to see if there's a bidding war, and there was, and they were, the price was going up, but it was, you know, this thing, this is not, this distributor hates it when I say this, but this film's not for everyone. And that was, we weren't trying to be, you know, overly subversive, and this isn't for mass consumption, but there is a specificity to this that we had the luxury of executing because we didn't spend a lot of money. You don't have to put a lot of people in the tent to recoup this big money. So you don't have to round the edges, and you can have some, where's the poster? You can have some crazy looking poster that that sets the mood and gives you a message of what to expect, and don't buy a ticket for this film unless you're in the mood to see something a little left. So Focus, fortunately, was the distributor that won out, and they kept up with some of the other more mainstream distributors that might not treat this in the way that I think you have to, which is to have a slow rollout and yeah, show it to sophisticated people like yourself and hope that you like it and hope that you tell your friends, and that starts to creep across the country a little bit. And, you know, Focus knows how to do that, and there's a couple of other distributors that do, and like Wes Anderson's film just opened in 4 theaters, right, last weekend, and it's, you know, there's going to be in 5, and Juno started like that. So there's a way for them to do that, and I'm enjoying learning about that. But
well, you nailed our audience there, so let's see if you have any sophisticated questions over here.
What would you say the hardest part was about acting and directing?
I'll just repeat so everybody can hear. What was the hardest part about doing both acting and directing?
Well, pre-production and post-production was brand new to me. I've never, ever seen what happens there. I didn't even know the director has an office in pre-production, truly. I didn't know who the first hire was. The production designer is the first hire, then the location manager, then the costume designer. It just seems like that. It's just so that was educational to me. I don't want to say that this was easy, but it was very comfortable. So I don't know what the hardest part was, except probably to not keep the crew there 15 hours a day, because it was so fun for me. And I just, it's like being at your favorite playground and not wanting to close, really. It was a great experience.
How long was the shoot?
29 days.
Wow. Okay. Anybody else? Okay, go ahead. Oh, did you? What was your involvement in picking the music?
Yeah, all of it. I mean, and that's it's another thing that, you know, actors just, you know, don't you dare, you know, call, you know, email the director with, hey, just, well, you know, no pressure, but I think that's one of the things a director gets to play with. And yeah, you pick the needle drop stuff, you know, the Pumpkins and the Beastie Boys and Black Keys, but you also pick the composer who scores the film and writes all sort of the music that is meant to either enhance a scene or hold your hand through one or offset it, and that's the part that I will spend more time with on this next one. It was shocking to me how little time that part of the process is given. How little the money is for that, which correlates to the time, because it has such a huge effect over us when we watch a movie, right? I mean, I'm sure we've all seen those. I don't know, they're on YouTube or anywhere now where. Well, we're going to show you this scene without music, and now we're going to show it with music, and you're like, wow, that's a different effect. And so you want to spend a ton of time with that, and you just don't. And so I'm going to try to do that a little bit earlier on this next one because it's so fun. Rolf Kent, I think, did a great job. This composer did a lot of the Alexander Payne movies and the Jason Reitman films, and so he kind of gets this comedy yet drama, and it was great. And the Beastie Boys gave us some great deal on their music. They don't do that. And I had the pleasure of meeting Adam Yauch a few times. Unfortunately, he wasn't around when we were asking them to use this music. But I have to assume that maybe he said something to Mike D and Adam Horovitz, and
great.
That's why I ran into them at a Rangers game during post-production, like just after we'd gotten the rights to the film, and I went up to them and I introduced myself and I said, thanks so much for that deal you guys, yeah. And what the hell are you talking about? Tell me your name one more time, and we don't handle that stuff, that's another guy, but good luck with your film. So it's very humbling, but they were very nice, and the Black Keys actually have a good relationship with the guy who is our music supervisor, so that was a streamlined thing. They're another favorite of mine. And then Smashing Pumpkins was, Billy Corgan was super nice about it, so got very lucky with that, because it's important, right? It sets a tone. Yeah.
Right over there.
So
that's actually,
yeah. So what was that weird racist cartoon that we see in the hotel room?
You're giving me more credit. That was actually, you're very limited to the stuff that you can clear that doesn't cost you a lot of money. And I did know that I wanted some kind of vintage cartoons on, but it just so happened that there was kind of like, what was it, like an Arabian guy in blackface or something? It was like... you're right, but I just Close Encounters is one of my favorite movies, and I just remember there was always this off camera distant sound of the television playing that had cartoons on it, and it just lent this feeling of kind of benign, domestic, kind of nothing ever bad could ever happen here. That was a great thing that was underneath the stakes that these guys were dealing with, and I don't know why that was always in my head, but that was kind of the target I was trying to hit there.
Okay, right down here.
I believe the title of this film has increased tremendously the interest of people who want to go and see it.
Good.
Have you any idea how that title was?
Oh, so the title she thinks is a good selling point for the film. So how did you... Was the title always there, or do you know how the title was...
The title was always there. That's all Andrew Dodge, who wrote a great, great script. It's obviously... It's much more a play on... The spelling bee element of the film than I think it is literally about. I mean, sure, we say some very off-color things, but in comparison to Wolf of Wall Street, for one, I mean, it's like, I don't want to kick that movie at all, but this is, we've all been in theaters where we've heard much, much, much worse. I hope it is not seen as a cheap way to get people in the seats. You're not buying it. Yeah. I don't mean that because I didn't title it, but this is, again, the film's not for everyone, and some people might be put off by that title, and it's, there are plenty of films for them, and they're welcome not to see this movie. I get it.
Yeah. Got you here, right? No,
I don't think so. I don't think she's a fan.
Okay, over here. Oh, did you make it? It was a great script, but did you have to make any changes or do something a little different?
The voiceover, which is admittedly a crutch, it was not as much in the original script as it ended up being. Once I started working with Andrew, and once I started deciding on where I kind of wanted to take the film, I needed it more. And maybe as I get better as a filmmaker, I'll be able to say some of the things that were in voiceover, I can say maybe with images or music or something, but I ended up increasing. One example of, yes, how the script changes would be voiceover. I tried to make it a little less sweaty by making it an apology letter, and that this voiceover ended up not being narration, but in fact a letter that he was reading the entire time. And I thought that was kind of like maybe an interesting way to excuse it. That was definitely one of the changes. And the whole montage that you know, when I take him out and night out on the town and stuff, all of that was changed. There were a lot of those things are some of the things that, not that I have done, but I have thought about and heard about. It's a real privilege to work with a writer that is egoless enough and has your shared sensibility, where you can just sit in there and collaborate and say, what about this? I mean, the menstruation scene for one. I mean, that was a set piece where we just needed to see that Guy Trilby is willing to go to a place beyond what we have seen yet. And in the script, it was, I'm spelling a word and a guy in the back of the auditorium, says, who ordered the martinis? Or maybe it was pizzas or something. And I go, right up here, buddy. And he walks up, and everyone in the audience is like, what's going on here? And I like sign a bill, and I take a shot of a martini, and I finish spelling the word. And I thought, that's funny, but I think we can take a bigger swing here. bad idea. He tricks this little 13-year-old into having her first, menstrual cycle. We're not doing that, but like that's kind of what. And he's howling. And he said, how would that go? I go, it wouldn't go. He said, no, just listen. And we spent about an hour or so just writing that out, and thought, well, maybe there's a way to do this. And that's just the challenge. You try to calibrate these things, and I added, that was one of the pieces that I definitely added VO was right before that. I say, my behavior at time was despicable at best. I'm lucky I didn't get killed by the parents or the kids. And then right away I say, hey, is that your hair clip down there? And it starts. And the music, we change the music to get a little bit more plucky and whimsical and less ominous. And you try to, because it's a tough little sequence, I would have made it shorter, I think, if I could re-edit it. But it's okay to be a little uncomfortable in a film like this, I think.
Okay, up towards the back there, yeah.
It's a pleasure. It's fun. Thank you guys for staying late.
After directing for the first time, is there a thing or two that you wish you knew?
I mean, you know, we sit in the editing room for 20 weeks. We only shot this for 6 weeks, and prep was 8 weeks. So you sit in there for 5 months, and you watch take after take after take and different sizes of coverage, and you learn that the camera sees a lot, you know, because we're watching, right? You're looking at the actor's eyes. The camera might be showing you this great composition, you know, with something happening in the background, but you end up looking at the actor and the actor's eyes. So what I wish I would have known earlier in my career was to trust that the camera's watching and to trust that you're watching, and that should inform your level of communication. And it is always fun to kind of lean in and think you saw something as opposed to being shown something. So basically a level of subtlety, you know.
Is there a difference between film and television in terms of subtlety?
Well, just medium-wise, television is a smaller screen, so you might have to up it a little bit. Theater actors famously have to be bigger to hit the back row. Television actors a little bit less, because they've got the telescopic element of the camera, yet a small television, although nowadays they're big. And film acting, it's huge. So you can just think something and it'll come across without you doing anything with your face. Especially if you are having a dialogue with the director and the director says, I'm going to be telling the audience what you're feeling with music in this. So just stand there, dummy, you know? Yeah, I'd said that to myself a gazillion times, because you feel guilty. You're getting paid to act. So you feel like I got to act. I got to do something with my face. But just sitting there and being, you know, a vessel for the audience to... I mean, being the straight man all these years, it's, you know, somebody does something funny and then you cut to me just being the vessel. That's all we want. We just want somebody to be us going, Jesus Christ, what am I looking at? You know? So it just takes trusting that.
Okay, over there.
Great cast. Was it fun to pick who you're going to play with?
Oh, how did you like the casting process?
Yeah. Oh, thank you. Thanks, buddy. Yeah, that was a fun one. The casting process was pretty simple, actually. Rohan and the kids were the only people that auditioned. That and the guy who plays the FBI agent, who has that great scene with Catherine, who gives her the dossier, I guess you call it. Catherine Hahn is a friend of mine. I asked her to play that part. She said yes. Allison Janney, same thing. Steve Whiting, Philip Baker Hall, I didn't know, but certainly did not need to see him audition. Ben Falcone, I knew, I asked him. Rachel Harris, they were all friends of mine, and I was lucky enough that they said yes. It's helpful because I'm on the mouse wheel, you know, little feet going as fast as I can, trying to do a bunch of things I'm not used to doing. And so, if you have a bunch of very talented actors that don't need a lot of direction, it freed me up to do a lot.
Okay. Right over here.
Were there any scenes in particular
that
you really enjoyed filming, favorite?
Oh, did you have any scenes that were really favorites of yours to film?
I liked doing the driving at the end. That was fun. You know, it's kind of cool to have streets locked off and you're being allowed to spin cars around corners. And it was a little difficult because the cameras were on what's called these hostess trays that are just right off the window, so you couldn't really see where you're going. And I got the little kid next to me, and the brakes were rigged on this old cop car, and it locked up a couple times, almost went through a lady's house. We had one visual effect in the movie, and it was removing the brake lights for me overcorrecting on that spin. I almost went up on the curb and hit the brakes. We had to remove the brake lights, so it looked like Guy was a better driver than I am. You know?
Okay. Any more? Right over there.
Oh,
the sex scene. Yeah, very, very romantic scene.
Well, it's tough. I mean, I don't know how many of you hippies like to get your drink on and nail your friends, but I'm not into that. So it's uncomfortable when you're going at it with your buddy, Catherine, So that was a little nerve-wracking. We had a lot of giggles with that, and there was a necessary comedic vigor at which we had to go at it. You know, the scripted yep, don't look at me. That was in the script, but it was a bit of a I think the kids call it, excuse my language, a hate fuck, right? And so and she's my buddy, and I'm buddies with her husband, and there's a bunch of dudes in the broom closet with cameras and stuff, and so it got uncomfortable, and I realized about three takes in, since we're kind of under the sheets here and our clothes are on, I could put a pillow between us, and now I can get that comedic vigor going and not be rude to my friend. So we put the pillow in between us, and then it made us both a lot more comfortable. And but then revisited the creep level by, you know, directors have what's called a clamshell, which is a little monitor that you can see what the camera's getting. If you don't want to sit in Video Village, you want to like stand a little closer to the set and you can see what the camera's seeing. I'm in that scene, and I need to be able to see what that side angle is getting as we're going away. So I had a little TV right behind her head while I'm going at her. It was, you know, it's a very sexually deviant thing that one might incorporate into one's bedroom if you were a sexual deviant. As you know, it's a step above the mirror on the ceiling. So that was a little creepy because. You know, I'm not supposed to be looking at her, but she knows I'm looking at a TV of me, you know, nailing her, and it's like, it was awful. But
how many takes did you film?
Oh, it felt like forever, but there was quite a few, and then in the shower scene, you know, she's such a good sport. By like the second or third take, I came up with this really perverted, dumbass idea that Guy Trilby is a guy who might, or no, that she, because it's her idea, because I say, oh, you are sorry. Oh, that's generous. And then I say, does this make it easier? And then I was trying to make it clear what it was that she was doing. And I don't, for some of you who didn't get it, I'm not going to explain it to you, but she got it. And the way that she tried to make it tried to communicate to you guys was I turn around and I say, don't look at me. I get it. And I turn around and I see Catherine's in the back of the bathtub. And she's got her mouth buried in the crook of her elbow. So it sounds like her face is in my ass, you know? So she's saying, no, I got it. You know, I was like, I didn't ask her to do that, but she's a giver, you know? There's a better way to say that, but...
Wow, okay. Thanks for asking that question, by the way.
And this lady right here is she's over it. I lost her at the title. I apologize, ma'am.
She's still here. She's having fun, right? Okay. Do you have a question?
Yeah. Not a question. I just want to say, great movie. I hope you keep directing.
Thank you.
And Thank you.
Okay, we'll just take a few more. So,
did you ask anyone for advice beforehand, being first-time?
Did you ask anybody for advice, like your old pal Ron Howard, maybe?
Ron Howard and Jason Reitman and Sean Levy and Steve Brill and Mitch Hurwitz. I had them come over and watch the rough cut at Jason Reitman's house. He's got this beautiful little screening room at his home. And I showed it to them, and it was very nerve-wracking. I mean, I hadn't shown the movie to anybody at that point. And I prefaced it by telling them that the editor's assembly was only 94 minutes. You know, a movie at its minimum is 90. And so we didn't have more than 94 minutes of footage because it was short at schedule, so I shot a very small script. And so I said to them, I said, if 20 minutes of this movie sucks, don't tell it because I can only cut 4 minutes. And they were very, very kind. They helped. They gave me some good tips about how to kind of calibrate that he might be a little spiteful here, and you might want to enhance this to earn that, and that kind of balance, and what to do with music, because this was before the this was all temp music, and I was very grateful.
Okay, so say two more over here.
What's your view on Netflix's pursual of original content, and any plans to work with them as a director?
So what's your view about Netflix and their creating original content, and do you have projects you might do with them?
I would love to work with them. They're in a, you know, so exciting what they're doing for all of us, right, as viewers. I mean, it's a great service that they are bringing us. So that is my view of that. That it is, you know, the more the merrier. And my experience with them on Arrested Development was that they have this very common sense approach to, they hire the creatives to do the creative work, and they cut a check and allow you to do that, and don't really get in there and homogenize the execution. You know, they know what they're great at, and they know what you're great at. We're not bright enough to do what they do. They're not interested in doing what we do, and so I'd love to. Yeah.
Okay. Over there.
Great movie. I really loved it.
Thank
you.
Thank
you. I have a very important question from your hairdo.
Is this crooked? God damn it! I should reapply. You guys, give me 1 second. Is the netting showing?
Regarding your hairstyle in the movie.
Oh, in this?
Yeah.
A totally different piece.
Yeah.
Expensive.
It's different than what I've ever seen you with, so I was wondering what the choice was like.
It just seemed like kind of a Guy Trilby, misanthropic, I don't give a shit, I just want to be able to shower, and I don't even want to buy shampoo. And, you know, an actor tries to change what it is they do each time. And we were shooting Arrested Development all the way up until, at least my part in those episodes for Netflix, until Friday. And I shaved my head on a Saturday, and we started rolling film on this on the Monday. So I spent the weekend weeping, looking at my, like, what have I done? But I felt like it kind of fit. It was... I would love to do it again. Very, very easy, low maintenance.
Our rule at the museum is you have to you direct 4 films and then you can get a retrospective. So we hope to see the next 3.
Thank you guys for coming in.
And thanks so much.
Thank you for listening. The Pinewood Dialogues at Museum of the Moving Image are made possible by generous support from the Pannonia Foundation. To learn more about the museum, visit www.movingimage.us.